Hello, and welcome once again to the Turkey Book Talk podcast. I'm William Armstrong, and in this podcast I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its region. This week's guest is Ryan Gingras, Associate Professor at the Naval Postgraduate School, and the author of a new biography called Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, Heir to an Empire. It's published by Oxford University Press, and it's reviewed by me in the Hürriyet Daily News this week. In today's Turkey, Atatürk's legacy is still bitterly contested. Approaching the centenary of the Republic, the westernization, secularization, and modernization process led by Turkey's nationalist founding father still provides the reference against which various political movements define themselves, whether sympathetic or antagonistic. Ironically, Atatürk's most ardent admirers and fiercest detractors both tend to suggest that the Kemalist project came as a bolt out of nowhere. But in fact, scholars have in recent years emphasized the many continuities from the late Ottoman to the Republican periods. As its title would suggest, Gingras's Heir to an Empire is the latest book to make that case. At 200 pages, it's an excellent biography for both the general reader and the specialist. I started by asking Ryan Gingras about why he wrote the book now and what he wanted to achieve with it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a project that was brought to me, I want to say maybe 3 years ago, and it was inspired, as I understand it, by two issues. One, that while there are Atatürk books on the market, there are none in print that are short. And there was an eye towards the fact that also the very recent Atatürk biographies were not generalist biographies. They were kind of had a specific eye towards one aspect of his life or another. The other was for the classroom market. Evidently, some sort of study was done or poll was taken. I don't quite remember the details, but professors who teach world history, when asked what biography they would like to have to use in the classroom to assign, a lot of people, if not the majority, said Atatürk. So this was done in conjunction with a series of other biographies that were commissioned to be written. And it was eventually sort of the project was started with Perseus Press and then went over to Oxford and released alongside a biography of, it's a really strange group of historical characters I'm about to list, but these were the characters: Thatcher, Queen Victoria, and Anwar Sadat, and Atatürk. So these were, and so evidently this list was pretty much, or this sort of first iteration of biographies were commissioned because these were biographies that professors wanted to assign but didn't have short ones to give to a classroom.
And there was a gap in the market.
There was a gap in the market. And so I had a kind of short window to turn it around. I think it was around 18 months. And was kind of given sort of target specs, you know, a certain word length. And, you know, since I didn't have that much time to do it, they basically said to me, look, this is supposed to be a reflection of the state of the field. Don't go out and try to reinvent the wheel. Just kind of give us what your impressions is of how people who've written about him and how people are generally thinking about him within this field. And so I tried to put that together in about between 50,000 and 60,000 words.
And one of the things that you do in the book is, it seems, you manage to successfully kind of float above the fray and avoid getting involved in any polemics. And instead, you make the point that it's more important now to understand Atatürk in his historical context. It always seems to me that this is something that both critics and fans of Atatürk have always failed to do.
I think that where people are, the people who are now kind of leading the charge within the history of the Ottoman Empire, history of Turkey, is to kind of get beyond this monolith and look at him within, you know, the context. I think that, you know, for basically ever since his presidency, there has been a desire to place him as this kind of the chief architect, the engineer for the period, its trends, the culture of the country, the politics of the country, and so on. And I think justifiably, with distance, people have now begun to put the equation back in its rightful sort of order, and that look at how the culture, the context, the conditions, continuities, discontinuities shape the individual, and how that individual interacted with them. And you look at anything that's sort of been written in the last 10 years or so on him, this has been, or at least sort of generally around him in his period, this is how people have gone about doing it.
I mean, the book is subtitled Heir to an Empire, so it does emphasize this aspect. I mean, like you say, historians, I suppose, in recent years have really emphasized these big historical continuities from the Ottoman to the Republican periods.
Yeah.
I think in the book, that's what becomes clear. In a way, the Republican reforms were this very big, radical, symbolic break and a new beginning. But as you say in the book, in many ways, they were building on foundations that went back decades into the late Ottoman period.
There's a lot of, I think in some ways it's a nuance, but it's a really important nuance of, firstly, not only what the continuities are, but the degree to which that we should think about the Ataturk period as not so much a break, but as a continuation of what happened before the Republic began. And I think there's some, there's good reason to sort of think of it as both a break and a continuation. But you're right. I think that I liked the idea of thinking him as an heir because, if there's one thing that's sort of definitive in his mind, definitive about his period as, and what makes his life significant is that the empire ends and he is kind of the clear transitionary figure from, from the end of one state and the beginning of a new state, right? And so hence the heir part. I think that this is, if you look at what people have generally been doing, not just talking about Ataturk, but just generally talking about Turkey in general, is trying to tease out more of what, to the degree to which the people and ideas that shape the end of the Ottoman Empire linger on into the early Republic. And Ataturk is the premier example of that.
What do you think are some of the most important continuities, both institutional but also intellectual? I mean, what would you point to as the most, maybe the five most important or significant continuities between the Empire and the Republic?
I think first and foremost, and one could not just say this about the Kemalist period, one could say about it even now, is that, the late Empire begets this perception in politics and these imperatives in politics that are very, very statist, the preservation of the state at all, at the expense of, society, to the point of society, acts as this engine and the framework around which, so much of the politics unfolds. And the idea of this kind of unitary state, that a state that, is really uncompromising in what its chief prerogatives are, that the state is sort of at, is at the center of all manner of political debate. I would say that that's number one. I think obviously, the second obvious thing people always point to is that, if you were to look at a lot of these personalities, including Ataturk, but well beyond him too, who are rattling around in both Istanbul and then later Ankara, there are a lot of continuities. There are historians who would actually call this something like the continuation, a sort of continuation of the Young Turk period, the Young Turk period beginning in 1908 and then sort of beginning to come to an end in 1938. I'm not sure if I totally assigned myself to that idea, but I'm really clearly if you were to look at not just someone like Ataturk, but let's say somebody like Ziya Gökalp, the so-called, father of Turkish nationalism, he transcends this era. There are other examples too. I guess beyond that, I think it's this kind of, if you were to drill down still further, it's still this ongoing discussion of what is the content of the nation. What does it mean to be an Ottoman, and in turn, what it means to be a Turk? It continues to, it's a question that continues to play itself out throughout this period. Although I would suggest that, the main point of transition, or this main axis of transition, is that this question becomes, a much, much more clearly framed by after 1923, after, after the empire is over. And what this nationalism begins to mean is, or what it's, where the contours of being a Turk become so much more clearly defined by the late 1920s and early 1930s than it does at any point before. I've kind of given you three. I don't want to go into five. We'd be here a lot longer. But I would say that those are, those are the things that kind of right off the top, this is something that we talk about quite with some length in the book.
I definitely want to come back to the Young Turk, to Atatürk's relationship to the senior Young Turks, particularly during the war. But first of all, I was just wondering, it always seems that Mustafa Kemal's early life is almost shrouded in mystery. In every biography you read, people really struggle to really say anything concrete at all about his parents. I mean, he was born in Thessaloniki in modern Greece, probably in 1881, but even that's not clear. And yeah, his early life is very thinly sourced and very difficult to get a grip on. I mean, what are the main challenges for a historian researching this period of his life?
I would sort of, my reaction to that is more in the fact that how unfortunate it is that we actually have to go back to this period. Because I think if you look at almost any major political figure, from the late Ottoman Empire, it's almost impossible to really tell the story of their youth. One of the initial points I raise in the book is that we only begin to get a handle on his youth by the time he's already famous. He gives this very famous interview in 1922 in the winter. And by that point, he's already a person of note in world politics. And it's very clear that at that moment, he's already beginning to shape his own autobiography. He's already beginning to, think about himself as, not only as a sort of celebrity and as a person of political significance, but in terms of his own legacies. So when you look at any anecdote related to his early life, one has to take a tremendous amount of assault, let's just say, with what those anecdotes mean, let alone whether they're accurate or not. I think the thing is, given his significance to Turkey, but also his global significance, there's a sort of a deep-seated imperative for both those who are writing his biography, but as also those who are interested in his biography, to know about his youth and to know about these sort of the foundations that made him who he was. Because in actuality, if you look at his biography as it unfolds in his times, in his contemporary biography, people don't really begin to know who he is until he's much, much older. And his political significance only begins to be, begin to become very clear, when he's already kind of had a very mature, he's already matured and he's already had a really well-established professional career. So having said all that, it's really impossible to say who he was as a young man in anything like impartial terms.
Now, to go back to the Young Turk regime, or the Committee of Union and Progress, the CUP, it was in power through the First World War, essentially since 1908, when there was a kind of constitutional revolution. But Atatürk wasn't one of the most senior people in the administration. And you get this sense throughout the war that he was very critical of how the war was being conducted. And there's almost a sense of bitterness that he wasn't one of the most senior decision makers. But in a way, what struck me is that he's almost lucky not to be in this senior position, because it meant that his name wasn't disgraced like other figures like Enver Pasha or Talat Pasha. And he wasn't tainted. So, and in fact, he was very critical of them, which gave him a kind of crucial political capital in the years after 1918. So in many ways, the Kemalist era that followed after the Republic was declared in 1923, he defined himself in opposition to the CUP. But in many ways, it had a similar modernizing, centralizing worldview.
I think to go even further, I think, you know, you're right on all those points. I think that, you know, number one, you know, among the very few writings we have before he attains great fame are, you know, his, you know, these diary entries that some diary entries that he has, some letters. And among the topics that he talks about is his frustration, you know, his political frustrations, but also his political aspirations. I mean, it's very clear that he sees himself as somebody suited for greater authority than he has. And it's clear that he was something of a real political infighter. I mean, he did not hesitate at all in trying to go above chain of command, try to circumvent people of greater authority to get what he wanted. So, I mean, that's abundantly clear. And I think at first it's ironic that he did eventually use his relatively marginal political stature within the late Ottoman government as a weapon against not just individuals who were his political superiors during the war, but also, you know, much, much later in consolidating his own power in the Turkish Republic. You know, beyond that, I would also add that it's clear that he uses his biography. He uses the fact that he was so antagonistic towards the government, the wartime leadership in Istanbul, as a way to undermine the inability of the Young Turks to rule. And the idea that the Young Turks not just ruled poorly, but how they managed affairs was incompetent. And that eventually that was something that it's clear he used to consolidate a far more regimented and personalized kind of sort of rule over the republic. And to put it another way, you know, one thing we know about the Young Turks is that it was a highly factionalized group of individuals. The party itself was deeply fractured along personal lines, along the lines of personal cliques and so on, and that the leadership in the war was rather incoherent. I mean, to this day, we still don't really know how the government really worked during this era. And one thing that we know that, you know, Atatürk said and eventually kind of put into practice is the idea that no longer would there be this kind of incoherency in government. There would be a very clear sense of who was in charge, who was making policy, and also how policy would be executed. And that's something that he definitely does as a, you know, as president.
And he was very critical of the German generals he was put alongside. I think he was put alongside, he was commanding in Gallipoli alongside Limon von Sanders.
Yeah.
And he was very critical of all of them. And even when he went onto the front in the Middle East, he was never satisfied with the way the war was being conducted.
I mean, this is, you know, this kind of independence that he expresses openly, it doesn't necessarily translate into a kind of an antagonism towards, you know, foreigners or even foreign assistance. This, if you look at his presidency, there is not so much the presence of foreign advisors, but large numbers of foreign emigres, the importation of foreign, you know, laws and foreign practices pervade his administration as president. So I would not read too deeply into this period, more as an expression of where I think he was as a general and where the empire was militarily and politically at that time.
And as you describe in the book, of course, the Ottoman Empire and then the Turkish Republic went through a kind of 12-year period of war. You say that no corner of Anatolia was left unscathed by violence.
Yeah.
And it was almost like the whole landscape was just reduced to an almost tabula rasa. I mean, there were the Balkan Wars that started in 1912, and then there was the First World War, and then the War of Independence. It was 12 years in total. Would you say that this sense of exhaustion following this period of conflict was important in allowing Atatürk to push through some of the more controversial early reforms? There wasn't a kind of energy to resist in a way.
I think that's right. I would add to that, there's a sort of demographic fluidity that has to be taken into account as well. you know, the numbers of people who are displaced, the number of people who are killed off, the number of newcomers that come into the country even after the republic is established is so large. And there is such internal social disruption, there's such a degree of social disruption throughout the country that not only is resistance reduced dramatically after the war, but also there is something of an opening to create a new political culture, since so many people are already in living within the new confines, new regions, new cultures, and so forth. That it provides this opportunity that only existed, it did not exist to such an extent before 1912.
To conclude, I just want to focus on the kind of legacy of this early Republican era of Atatürk. And obviously it's very contested still in Turkey. But I guess, what do you think are some of the things that we can recognize in Turkish politics, in Turkish society today, that we can trace back to that Kemalist era, both negative and positive?
I think the first great legacy, I think, is not only obvious now, but it's obvious in within each turn in recent Turkish history, going back to 1923, is how important leadership and the personality of the leader is within contemporary politics. We tend to think about Turkey in its periods, how we break down the different eras that comprise the history of Turkey along the lines of the dominant political personality of the era, whether it's Atatürk, İnönü, Menderes, the sort of this intermediary period between 1960 to 1980, in which there's a real absence of it, right? I mean, there are contenders, whether it's Demirel or one of the generals or Ecevit. Again, the 90s, a sort of absence of a dominant, political, really dominant figure to the contemporary Erdogan period. I think that this is, personality is so important into how people think about politics, but particularly like sort of stable politics. I mean, obviously, the very principle of being Turkish, the centrality of language, the centrality of the land of Anatolia as being critical to being Turkish, the sort of the unitary nature of Anatolia, is still something so fundamental to contemporary Turkish life, not just political life, but social life as well. I think that the political culture, both in terms of the things that are celebrated in Turkish society and politics, but also so many of Turkish anxieties are born out of this era, and born in particular out of things that Mustafa Kemal himself talked about with great regularity, the celebration of the greatness of the Turk, of Turkey being not just a country, but a really central, important country within the making of world history, of world civilization. This is a trope that that still endures, popularly as well as within high politics, as well as, the idea of independence, the idea of the insolubility of the Turkish state, of the Turkish nation. This is something that people still debate and people still attempt to renegotiate in various ways in contemporary Turkish society and in politics. And I would also lastly sort of put the idea that it's very difficult to create or have in Turkey today a historical figure around which to sort of to talk about the ideals, let alone sort of aspects of change or reform in Turkey, without bringing Atatürk into the equation, at the expense of almost anything else or anybody else in Turkish history. While I would say Atatürk arguably no longer receives the kind of unquestioned reverence, at least within public media, as he once did, he still does provide certain, key benchmarks in talking about the past, talking about what leadership means, talking about what being Turkish means, talking about what Turkey means as a historical place. He's this sort of this monolith that sort of stands between contemporary society and, the full nature of Turkey as a place, as an idea, as a history.
That was Ryan Gingabas talking about his book, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, Heir to an Empire. You can find a link to my review of the book via my site, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Also on there, I posted a link to an interview I did with Ryan last year on his book, Heroin, Organized Crime and the Making of Modern Turkey, which was also a very interesting book. And you can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes and Podbean. Again, if you liked it, please take the time to rate it on iTunes, which helps make it easier for people to find. Meanwhile, until the next podcast, thank you very much for listening.